Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. I know what you're thinking. It's Monday, and new episodes usually come out on a Thursday. That's because until the end of the year, this podcast is going twice weekly. Every Monday and Thursday, you'll find a new episode in all the usual places. I had so many podcasts recorded that I wanted to share them as soon as possible. So, in this episode, the first Monday episode, I'm talking to Rochelle Atala about her speculative novel, The Pharmacist. Rochelle is a busy woman, and I had to grab a chat with her between the Edinburgh Festival, so she's in a cafe when we recorded. Rochelle is a Scottish-Egyptian novelist, short story writer and screenwriter based in Glasgow, and she previously worked as a community pharmacist for a decade. In this episode, we talk about how Rochelle's career as a pharmacist helped her create her main character, leaving gaps for the reader to fill in with their own imagination, and how her short story writing and screenwriting complement her novel writing. But first, here's Rochelle with an excerpt from The Pharmacist.
I stared up at Canavan's bunk, making out its sunken shape in the blue nightlight glow, when the generators cut out, plunging the entire bunker into total darkness. The power cuts usually only lasted minutes, but knowing this didn't make it any easier. I gripped my blankets and tried to visualise something that could trick me into distraction. I thought about the huge shopping mall and multi-storey car park that sat directly above us. I'd treated myself to some lovely boyfriend-style jeans and eaten ramen noodles with Officer Holden while his wife was at work. He couldn't operate his chopsticks, and I'd revelled in his having to ask for a fork. I so clearly remembered the feel of his hand gripping my thigh under the table. I shifted position. I could hear people breathing, quick and erratic, while a child cried out in the distance for her mother. I brought my hand up in front of my face, but I couldn't make it out. We had been told this particular bunker housed 0.2% of the city's population, the country's best minds huddled together. But in reality, it was mostly populated by politicians and bankers, the odd media mogul thrown in for good measure. They had had enough money and influence to protect themselves and their loved ones, but there was nothing particularly special or impressive about any of them. Where were the experts in science or academia? Could I assume that they were safe in another of the city's bunkers? We were a poor mix of a gene pool too. My mum's North African heritage within me must have been missed on admission. Pale enough to slip through the net when combined with the gift of a Western surname. When I was little, I used to force my parents to put their arms next to each other. The contrast in their complexions fascinated me. My brother and I, a perfect blend of them both.
Hi, Rochelle. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you about your brand new novel, The Pharmacist.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for having me. Delighted to be here.
So can you start by telling us what it's all about?
So The Pharmacist was a speculative kind of dystopian tale, and it follows Wolf, who is the pharmacist living in a nuclear bunker. She spends her days kind of monotonously doling out medication to the other inhabitants while they wait for the outside world to heal. And then when she is kind of introduced to the leader's rather kind of paranoid and reclusive political leader, ND, their worlds start to collide, and she is then forced to kind of consider what she's willing to do, what she's willing to sacrifice for her own personal gain. And I think it just opens up these kind of political and social questions about how we treat one another and what we do when we feel like the world's kind of closing in on us. I was definitely, when I was writing it, I was very much inspired by kind of like the populist leaders that we kind of put into positions of power. So there's quite a lot of strands that the kind of the politics of the bunker mirror, I would say, the politics of what we're kind of living through at the moment.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a bit about your kind of real world inspirations later. But I really wanted to start really with the beginning of your idea for this novel, because I saw an interview with you where you said you'd, when you started to come up with this idea, your main character, Wolf, her voice just kind of came to you and you just started writing. But I wondered whether you could talk to us about where that initial seed of an idea came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I had no real desire to write a story about a bunker before this. It wasn't like I had a huge fascination. I knew they existed, but I hadn't really been into any. And I also just kind of imagined them as these small little contained spaces. And then I was in Berlin in about 2016 with my husband and young son strapped to me. And we were in a museum, and unbeknown to us, as we were paying our money for the museum, they went, oh, if you want to come back at 2 o'clock, we'll give you a tour of the bunker. We were just kind of like, sorry, what? So sure enough, we went back, and then before we knew it, we were getting taken down, you know, like four flights of stairs past an underground car park, and then someone turned this big metal door, and we stepped in as a group of maybe 20 people into a community-sized post-war nuclear bunker. And I was just like, I was completely consumed by this. As soon as I stepped in, and it's dark and it's bleak, and you kind of walk around and you see what they had planned for, the provisions they were willing to take. And it was really, for me, it was quite a captivating space. And then I then thought, well, there's so many societal questions that come from this, you know, who gets chosen? You know, there's only a very small percentage of a population within the kind of vicinity that would fit into this bunker. So who's getting a place in here? And who do we still keep our kind of political hierarchies? And do we take into the bunker? And what are you willing to sacrifice, you know, from and leave the outside world? So that immediately came, my mind was in overdrive. But I come from novel writing as a short story writer. So I think instinctively I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a short story. And I started writing, when I got home, I started writing my notebook, and I was going to call it The Politician's Daughter. And I couldn't stop. Like, it was just pages and pages and pages. And then I thought, oh, actually, maybe this is the novel that I've been thinking about writing. And it was very instinctual. I kind of just let it leap from there. But when I thought about it as a novel, I didn't think that the voice I'd started from in the short story was strong enough to kind of pull the full story along in novel form. So I went back to the drawing board and I kind of thought for a while. And before I knew it, because I used to be a community pharmacist, and I, up until that point, I very rarely wanted to talk about pharmacy. I thought it was just like best to kind of compartmentalize, you know, like who's interested in hearing me talk about pharmacy. But then I think I just started. I thought, well, it could be a pharmacist that's in the bunker. And as soon as I kind of landed on that, it was kind of an epiphany moment. And then Wolf's voice quite kind of confidently arrived. And then, yeah, that was it, really. She just kind of pulled me along. And I wrote the first draft quite quickly. It obviously needed a lot of work after that. But I think, you know, within 6 months, I had a draft because I just couldn't stop. I was so kind of consumed by her voice and what she wanted to say. So that's how it came about.
And I think there's that cliche phrase of, you know, write what you know. But do you think that it helped you writing a character that was a pharmacist because you had that background? Because obviously with this story and with speculative fiction, you do a lot of world building. You have to work out the logic of what's happened and where they all are. So do you think using a career that you were familiar with helped you?
I don't think I was aware of it at the time. I think on reflection, massively, because I mean, obviously you have to do research, and I like it when I've done the research for a piece of writing. I hate it at the time. You know, I'm one of those terrible writers that puts in like research later and then you come back to the next draft and you're like, oh, I haven't done that yet. So I think I probably leaned on the idea of being a pharmacist because it was easy in the sense that I could just kind of keep the flow. And obviously when I started writing about it, there was just all these little moments that, I mean, it's all fiction, but the moments that I kind of add to the novel, you know, bear some sort of resemblance to the experiences that I've had. And I just think, actually, there was all these lovely kind of human interactions that I must have just banked and never thought were kind of worthwhile putting in the page. And here I was writing this book, and they just slotted in for me as a writer, like, quite naturally. And then it wasn't until I was kind of at the editing stage, I realized the potential power that Wolf could have by being a pharmacist, you know, by being in control of the medication and having power over other people. And I think although she perhaps doesn't realize the power she has at the start, by the end, she very much does. And I just thought that was really interesting. And I suppose it was then I was kind of reflecting my own career as well and thinking, you know, there's an awful lot of responsibility that comes with being a pharmacist. It did cause me quite a lot of anxiety when I used to practice, because I was in fear of kind of making mistakes, you know, or hurting people. And it's easily done. I mean, mistakes happen all the time. So I think that, yeah, whether I realised it or not, that there was probably a part of my career kind of being purged out of me onto the page. And I suppose it's just, yeah, it's your first novel. You know, everyone's trying to tell you, write something that no one else can write. And so part of me was like, well, I don't think anyone could write this. You know, I think, like, I mean, obviously people have written about bunkers before, but have they written about a pharmacist? No. So I'm going to give that a go. And that it's just something different, I guess. And that's what I thought I could bring to the book as a debut novel. Yeah.
And it works so well because it's a great way for Wolf to interact with a lot of characters. And it's, I guess it makes the structure of your novel in a way easier because she's got her career, has she got her day to day, the sort of drudgery of having to do the same job every day. And like you said, it makes her role surprisingly quite high stakes. You know, they're in a enclosed environment and everyone's got ailments, but if something happens, like, I don't think it's giving too much away to say one of the first scenes in the book is a character who swallows pieces of a Monopoly board and then gets, you know, severely injured from it. And your things that might be minor in our world suddenly become major in her world, and she is one of the main people that has to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think she appreciates that at the start. And I don't think she particularly likes that. And I think, I'm sure I mentioned in the book, you know, there's a line where she talks about when someone's ill on an aeroplane and there goes a medical person on board, and she goes, well, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a nurse. And I think, like, that's how I feel, you know, in real life. And so I think that feeling is I can relate to that. Yeah, I think we're very different people, Wolf and I, but I think moments like that the stakes are high, I have to help deal with this, and that kind of causes anxiety, I think, come across in Wolf, and they probably come across in me as well. And I think there are lots of little moments where she just has to step in, you know, she does have to take responsibility, and I don't think she would if she was in the outside world. I think if she was able to avoid it, she probably would.
One thing your novel does, which is one of the main reasons why I absolutely loved it, is that you left so much to the reader's imagination. There's so much unsaid about what's happened to the outside world. It's kind of implied that it's potentially nuclear war, but we never find out whether that's the case. And we don't know what's on the outside. We don't know whether everyone is dead. We don't know what's happened. And, you know, I think I can say that we don't find out what has happened. Did you enjoy that element of kind of teasing little bits of information but leaving so much blank, and was it difficult for you to decide how much to give away?
Well, firstly, yes, I love deciding what to share with the reader and what not. But I think I mentioned this earlier, I come from short story writing, and I feel like with short story writing, the main thing you're always kind of drilled in to do is leave plenty of room for the reader. But there's always got to be space for interpretation and speculation. And so it was a real natural instinct for me to think, well, I'm going to use that same principle in novel form. It's also just the type of thing that I like to read. I like to read things that leave space for me and don't have to fill in all the blanks. I get it, you know, I'm there with you. And I like to think of reading as a kind of partnership between the author and the reader. You know, we're both bringing something to it. I'm offering you something and you're going to come away with an interpretation. So yeah, all that very much interests me. It was a kind of natural decision to, I think that is how I write, that is my style. But finding the balance, I think it's just, yeah, that's a kind of pull and push game, isn't it, that comes in the editing. And I think that was mostly from the editors being like, I think I need a little bit more here. And I would kind of go reluctantly, like, fine, I'll give you, I'll tease a little bit more there. But yeah, I mean, if you don't read short stories, then you maybe don't like that there's lots of room left on the page. I think we were saying earlier that I've certainly had people be quite frustrated at some of the information that I chose to leave out. But the other thing I felt was quite important was I wanted Wolf to be a first person narrator, and I wanted it to be unreliable. So I think I very much wanted it to feel like you're getting her version of things. They're not necessarily always right, but that's the only perception that you're getting. Because I just think that we do that. We do our own kind, we're our own narrators, unreliable narrators, and we can very much easily filter what we say to one another and the perception we try and project. So I really wanted that to come across with Wolf. I think there's also this sense of some things are going to be really difficult for her to talk about. So she's only giving the information away that she feels comfortable with sharing. And I think from a human point of view, that's a really interesting place to come at from writing and from a character.
Mm. I already know the answer to this because I've asked you before we started recording. But did you have a clear idea of what's going on in the world and the elements of the story that you haven't given away?
I have been asked this quite a lot. And I'm not going to give a definitive answer because I don't, hand on heart, fully 100% know. My gut instinct is probably that there has been nuclear war, I think. But I think from Wolf's perspective, you need hope. So I think the world might be fine outside, who knows, but it may well have had kind of a nuclear disaster. But for her not to know is almost kind of a blessing, for her to be able to tease this idea of herself that actually maybe they are, everyone above ground is fine, maybe her loved ones are surviving and she's taking the punishment. You know, there is this kind of moment where they consider is the worst of society and humanity in this bunker, because you know, all of them, maybe apart from the children perhaps, all of them are flawed in some way. As a society. Maybe is the very vague answer that I'm willing to give on that.
And what about kind of life before the bunker? Because we do get some information about Wolf's relationships, her family, her ex-partner, and the kind of events that led up to her going into the bunker. Had you done a lot more work in terms of kind of fleshing out that element of it and the kind of the lead up to the bunker and then just not included it, or was that something that you'd only done kind of like a small amount of work on because you knew it wasn't going to be included?
I think I did a lot of backstory thinking and jotting down, but I always thought it was just for me. I didn't ever plan on giving people much backstory. I'm not a massive fan of backstory generally. And again, maybe that comes from being a short story writer and you just don't really have the economy to go into too much backstory. But I also thought that I just wanted to give the reader the absolute minimum that they needed to go with the story and for them to fill in the blanks. And so I think when I came to the book, I had a very clear idea in my own mind of, you know, life for Wolf beforehand. But I was very conscious that I only wanted to give, again, kind of in that sense of what she comfortable kind of divulging to herself or to, you know, to us as a reader. And again, I think that's probably some people would criticize the lack of backstory. So people are like, I want to know what happened before. But when I started writing the book, I knew very, like, the first chapter has probably the chapter that's changed the least in the entire draft. So I knew that it was going to open with them seeing this man lying on the ground who had eaten Monopoly pieces. Again, I'm really keen on this kind of idea when you're telling stories or thinking about stories, you know, you start as late as possible and you take the first exit out. And I wanted the reader to feel like, oh, you know, this world already exists and we're actually just entering it now, but this is a familiar world to everybody else. Because I tried to write a novel before this one, which was contemporary and not dystopian. And I remember I had a mentor through the Scottish Book Trust for it. And I'd written like 12 pages of this like really beautiful backstory to her. And my mentor was like, where does the story start? And I was like, oh, what do you mean? On page one, right here. And she's like, no, but I know a lot about her, but what's the story about? And I remember just thinking like, that was like one of the best pieces of advice I've ever given. Like, where do you want your story to start? Where do you want your reader to pick up from? And I think because I wanted it to feel really claustrophobic and I wanted it to move quickly, you know, I wanted it to feel like lightning. Sometimes I think backstory can be a hindrance and it kind of pulls you out. So yeah, Rightly or wrongly, that's what I want. I
love the way you did it, because you, like you say, you're in there with Wolf, and I felt I trusted you as a writer to give me the information when I needed it, and I knew that eventually I would find out information. But you're, like you said, there's no moments where we go, and now is a flashback, and now we have a chapter about her life before the bunker. We only get the information when it's, when it fits. And I love that, because you're there in the bunker the whole time. That probably adds to the reader's feeling of claustrophobia with your characters. And I think it works so well. And I mentioned to you before we started recording, I love novels where there's enough space for the reader to put in their own perspective and for them to fill in the gaps themselves. And your novel does it so well, because I didn't feel unsatisfied, because I feel like I had a full picture of what was going on and her life beforehand, even if you hadn't necessarily told me about it. So I think it worked so well. I wanted to touch on, you mentioned the novels in first person perspective, and obviously from Wolf's perspective. She, like you mentioned, alongside many other characters, is incredibly flawed, does some quite morally ambiguous things, particularly towards the end. And do you think using first person helped make her perhaps more empathetic, or do you think it was something you used because you wanted the reader to just almost accept the world you were portraying?
A bit of both, to be honest. I think when I started writing it, yes, it was, I wanted the reader to accept that this was the world and we're seeing it through her eyes. But as I continued to write, I realised, I'm very fond of Wolf, but I realised actually, if you weren't seeing the story from her perspective, I don't think you would empathise with her. I mean, she could easily be a bad, she could easily be a baddie in another story, seeing through someone else's eyes. I love that kind of moral ambiguity of characters. And I think flawed characters are just really interesting to read about and write about. I mean, nobody wants to read a story about someone that just behaves perfectly all the time, So I think flawed characters are just really interesting. I would 100% think that if the story had not been told from Wolf's perspective, I think some people would definitely struggle to empathise with her. And I suppose when you tell it in first person as closely as you do with Wolf, it gives you, I've had some readers say you feel you're in her mind, you're with her the whole time. And I think when it's set in that environment, you need something like that. You need to have someone that, yes, obviously there are certain things they don't want to talk about and they might not confess that, but the things they are talking about are very confessional, nothing is kind of held back, her bowel movements and, the way she's treated other people in her life. I think, I think that felt really human to me, because we're all flawed, and we're hopefully not as flawed as Wolf and some of the other characters, but we are flawed human beings, and I think we need to kind of acknowledge that.
And I guess when they're in an environment like that, the flaws come to the surface a bit more, because they are in such an extreme environment. I want to talk a little bit more about the kind of psychology of your characters, because we've got Wolf, and we've also another character that I think is worth talking about is your main leader, which is a character called ND. Mm-hmm. And all your characters I think are so interesting and complex, but ND is a very unusual character, and I can really feel, and I know you've spoken about it briefly earlier, the influences from the real world to help build you as a character. So can you talk a little bit about that, because I'm assuming the influences may have been Trump, may have been Boris Johnson. So give us a bit of a background on his psychology, really.
I started writing this 2018 into 2019. And yes, Donald Trump was in power. And I am one of those people that is a worrier. So, I lie awake at night, probably reading the wrong articles just before you go to bed, and then lie awake thinking, what's happening to the world? And, I have two young children, and I'm kind of constantly worrying about, the world that we're leaving for them. Donald Trump, I couldn't believe. It's the age-old tale of how someone like him gets into power. It's not as if it's new. It's just kind of history repeating itself. But I couldn't believe people had chosen to vote someone like him in, who was clearly so self-interested. He doesn't actually care about people, just wants division because it suits his agenda. And I think around the time it was also when there was the discussions with like North Korea and nuclear, you know, nuclear weapons. And it just really struck me that actually we put these people into positions of power. They make decisions that essentially affect all of us, but they never pay for the consequences. And so very much, I think, because I felt out, like I couldn't control that situation. I think it was kind of cathartic for me to try and explore that in fiction. It almost felt like my way of helping kind of articulate my own worries and thoughts on the page. And so, yeah, the first draft was very much written, not just with Donald Trump, but yeah, I mean, kind of populist leaders who are there to divide for their own benefit, who are happy to put people in danger, essentially. But I think also the fact that we have these weapons, like nuclear weapons, for example, that they have the potential for mutual destruction. I just think that's mind-blowing that we've got to a place where we're all like, I've got mine and you've got yours, but because of each god, we'll not fire. And then obviously with like Ukraine and Russia, you know, all these issues have always been bubbling away and they kind of pop up and everyone goes, oh my goodness, you know, what will happen? So that very much the forefront, and I kind of stand by the philosophy that I think you should be writing about what scares you. So at the time when I was writing this, that was very much on my mind. And then I finished the draft and I started editing it, and then Boris Johnson came into power, and I thought,
perfect timing. Yeah.
This is just the gift that keeps on giving. And I just thought, I mean, I'm on Twitter quite a lot and I follow politics quite a lot, so I felt quite heavily involved, but I think I'm not someone that's great at debating. You know, I wouldn't go into like Question Time and kind of try and voice my opinions. And I'm not wanting to force any political opinion on somebody. I just thought this was my way of being able to articulate myself about politics and what worries me about politics. So I think Indies ended up being a mash of a lot of the political leaders that we had kind of come across, particularly in kind of last five to 10 years. And I don't think... I mean, I didn't want to just like mimic one person, but I think, yeah, there's a mash of them all.
I mean, reading it, I don't read it and think, oh, that's Trump. Like, yeah. He feels very much like his own character. He doesn't feel like an idiot.
He's actually very charismatic, I think, is Andy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like you're trying to do your own version of Trump. He does very much feel like his own character. I think it's more... I mean, I guess it's probably you absorb stuff just through watching the news and things. Did you kind of read any kind of interviews with Trump and Johnson and any other leaders to kind of almost get into his head? Like, how did you manage to do that?
Not really. I didn't want to get too close to their particular voices. So I kind of had a notebook and anything that bothered me that was happening in the world at that time and how they were handling it, I'd be kind of think, oh, well, you know, and quite often none of it surprised me. I'd be like, oh, that's quite typical. So I suppose I just wanted to have this kind of vague projection put onto ND and the idea of like how someone like that comes into power and how they can continue to hold on to that power. And the fact that, you know, they're willing to change laws around them to suit them. I think that's, but again, I don't think any of that is new. I think people have been doing that in politics for generations before. I think we're just at a pivotal point again. But I think with ND as a leader, I very much wanted him to be, yes, obviously he's a populist leader and I've definitely borrowed things from people that exist. But yeah, I wanted him to be his own person. And what I was really interested in with ND was also showing someone that can flip from so being very charismatic and actually can be quite nice and caring and offer you lovely things to being someone that, you know, click of the fingers can be very, very cruel. Because I do think I'm very interested in how humans treat one another and actually how cruelty can come quite easily to us, especially with like people that we like. And so I think I wanted there to be that feel of you just didn't know what he was capable of doing, and I think that sometimes that takes people by surprise, until the end. So
yeah. And speaking of kind of timings, it was also, I'm guessing, during the pandemic you started doing where many of us were inside a lot of the time and had kind of restrictive lives. So I guess in a way that must have helped you build that very claustrophobic atmosphere in your novel.
So I mean, so I I'd sold the book just before the pandemic, and actually to the point where I thought, oh my goodness, are the publisher's going to like take the contract back? Does anybody want a novel about a pharmacist stuck in a bunker when we're about to just enter our own kind of little bunkers of a pandemic? I think the pandemic, I mean, I didn't want to live through a pandemic, but the pandemic helped me in the sense that I felt, I think before the pandemic came along, I was maybe asking the reader to really take a leap of faith that this could happen. Yes. It felt like it could very much happen to me. Like, I think with speculative fiction that I'm writing, I'm interested in the idea of, okay, it hasn't happened, but it could happen. This could be a real world that I've created. And I think the pandemic made people go, oh, actually, things we've taken for granted could just disappear overnight. You know, the things, the society that we assumed and how it works, could vanish. And I'm sure, I can't remember who said it, but there is that saying of, you're only 7 meals away from anarchy, and I think that's really true. And actually, you know, situations can change like lightning, and I think the pandemic helped people as a society to realize that. So I think I probably got people on board. So when they started reading The Pharmacist, they were like, oh, okay. Some people thought it was like a pandemic novel. I'm like, well, no, I wrote it before the pandemic. So I think there was obviously a lot of parallels that people found interesting or uncomfortable, and things they could relate to even more because they'd had to live through kind of extreme circumstances themselves. But yeah, I mean, even going through the editing process, I'd send a draft back to my editors and then the copy editor, and they were kind of like, are you predicting the future? You know, like, are you? And I think just the world we live in, you just never know what could happen.
I think you're right in a way. I think it's even more believable now we've sort of gone through lockdown and things. We can see these things, you know, hopefully not happening, but it feels like it could happen, and I think it's a lot easier to imagine. I think like you, I've enjoyed speculative fiction for a long time, but I think everyone said it when we were going through the early days of lockdown, like, it does feel like we're living in, you know, Station 11 or like a movie or something. So
yeah, and I think especially at the beginning, because nobody knew like what was going to happen, and so you are just living in your houses, and then you just, because this normal world that you had, is it being very quickly taken away from you, you then think, is this it now? Is this what life is going to be like? And you just didn't know what was going to happen. And even now, I mean, you know, the pandemic is still here. We're just living in a different world. And I think, yes, some form of normality has returned, but the exact carbon copy of the world before the pandemic, that has gone. I don't know if we'll ever get back to that, even if it's just a shift in thought and how we perceive things. And I think that all lends itself very well to speculative fiction. Yeah, I mean, speculative fiction is kind of trying to, imagine worlds that are maybe not that far away from the worlds we live in. And so when those two collide, it can be quite uncomfortable. As my editors, keep telling me.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things.
Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I want to move on to a happier note now and touch on your writing career kind of so far and in general, because you're not only just an author, you are a screenwriter as well, and you're a very successful screenwriter. So I wondered whether you could talk to us a little bit about how those writing roles work together, and how do you keep yourself kind of creatively nourished? Because if you're having to come up with ideas for novels, short stories, and screenplays, you must either have loads of ideas or have kind of ways of tapping into those nuggets of and seeds of ideas.
That's an excellent question, and you're catching me at a moment where I'm like, I think I do probably need to take a break soon and fill up the well. I mean, I probably loved films before I got into novel writing. So as a child, it was kind of films were my go-to. I wasn't actually a big reader until I got into my 20s and I kind of fell into writing classes as a hobby, and then started to understand what was good literature and like the types of things that I could be reading and enjoying. But I think I'm just quite a pragmatic person. So I started with the short story form, and I loved that. I'm still really passionate about that. And then when the time came, it felt like I was ready to try and learn and understand how you can move into novel. And then there was the opportunity to, I think there was a course running in Glasgow. They were looking for writers who, not just Glasgow, in Scotland, who were writing in other disciplines who were interested in screenwriting. And so at that point, I thought, well, actually, I am interested in screenwriting and film, so maybe this is something that I could think about. So I started to learn screenwriting a few years ago, but I'm at this position now where I've just written my first feature and we're trying to kind of get that funded. And I think, oh, actually trying to establish yourself as an author and a screenwriter at the same time, I would not recommend at all. It's very, very stressful. But then I just think, well, I love storytelling. I love understanding story, and actually I come to this kind of conclusion that I think there are some, you know, some stories need to be told a certain way, and I'm getting better at saying, well, I've got the seed of an idea, what's the best way to tell that? Is it a short story? Is it a novel? Is it for a screen? So I love the diversity, and I think I've learned there's definite things I take from each discipline that I think makes the pieces of writing stronger. The main thing for me as a prose writer before I started screenwriting was that I never planned anything. Like I was very much, I'd have like seed of an idea, and I would try and kind of think about the basic little points that I might want to meet, or, you know, imagine how it's going to end. But I never wanted to be too specific. So I always think it's good to have room to just kind of go off on a tangent if the tangent feels right. But I've discovered in screenwriting that's just really, really difficult to do. And actually, especially if you're trying to get funded your work, you need to show your producers and the commissioners that actually you can put down on paper an outline of a very clear story before you get to script. So that's something I very much grappled with. Now that I'm used to it, I can see the benefit of having a kind of 10-page outline or a 30-page treatment. And in that respect, I probably thought actually my prose could do with more planning, because it would probably save a lot of rewrites if you had a clearer idea of where you wanted to go with your novel. So I think like things like that are interesting. Just the practice is different, but take the positives from each and kind of merge them together. What I love about screenwriting is it's just really collaborative as well. I think with the novel, we were talking about this earlier, the pressure that you feel and the anxiety before this thing comes into the world, because it's your baby and you're the creator, and you know, yes, you have editors, but ultimately the final say is with you and you tell the story. And I think with screenwriting, the pressure's off a little bit, because as long as you've written a good script, you didn't have to have you hand it over. And I think the dynamics are different, because then all of a sudden you're just hoping you've got the right director. You know, can you trust the director to bring this story to life? And I wrote a short film that got commissioned by the BFI a few years ago, and actually that was a really, really wonderful process. And so that kind of gave me faith that actually, as long as you're working with the right people, you can bring that story to life in a completely different way than you could with writing a novel or a short story. I don't have great wisdom, except that I just work. I work all the time. I mean, I'm probably a bit of a workaholic. But yeah, just I have a notebook that I write the seed of an idea down, and I'll just kind of go through that every so often, because more so with film and TV, they do expect you, like, oh, can we have a meeting? And they're like, well, so what are you thinking of? You just kind of have some kind of quick fire ideas. So that's interesting, because I've never worked like that before, whereas with short stories and novels, I've always just let things percolate until I was ready to kind of put them on paper. So yeah, I'm learning. It's like a work in progress. But I think, you know, it's a hard life being a writer. And if you can tell stories in different ways, then that's got to be a good thing. And but it also, for me, I feel like I'm starting to build a kind of sustainable writing career in through these different forms.
I'm asking you for a very selfish reason, because I've said this on a podcast before. I'm a writer that I really struggle with ideas. I'm not someone that has 500 ideas and just can't get them down quick enough. Like, it takes me ages to come up with a really good idea and one that I want to spend time with. And you know yourself, when you've got an idea and you're writing a novel, it takes you months to write it, and then you've got to read it 100 times. So, you know, you've got to really love it. And
Basically,
one of my reasons for doing the podcast, and was selfish really, is that I'm hoping that one day someone's going to give me this nugget of advice that's going to change my writing career.
You're like, aha.
Where is it, Michelle? Where's this nugget of advice?
Yeah, I don't have it. I don't have a magic wand. But it'll be in there. Do you know what I think? I mean, sometimes...
Yeah, I think sometimes when you're in your head going, I need an idea, that is the time where you have none.
Exactly.
The time where you take a break and you... just watch a load of TV and read a load of books, that things come to you. And I think sometimes it's the pressure of having an idea that makes you
completely. I think there's nothing worse for creativity than pressure, someone kind of demanding you deliver something. And I mean, when I look back to the last year, I haven't written anything new in a long time. I've been so busy fleshing out, you know, whether it's novel edits or an outline for a film that I maybe had the idea for 2 or 3 years ago. And so then sometimes I think, when was the last time I actually sat down and wrote something new? And I would like to think that I think I need to work on my balance as well, of like when I'm working and when I'm off. Because I don't think writers are ever off. I think you're off, but you're still, whether you realise it or not, you're kind of thinking or percolating ideas. But yeah, I think the pressure, I totally agree, is something, it's just a buzzkill. It doesn't help creativity whatsoever. And I quite often find that I could, you know, I'll see something and I won't immediately think, oh, that's what I want to write about. But there'll be something in my head, and it could be a couple of years later. And then I think, well, actually, that was really interesting. That stayed with me, and that kind of slots in. It's all kind of random and, yeah, moments of kind of sparks that that you go, oh, actually, I must sit down and write something about that. I guess we almost come at it from different ways, I guess, whatever works for you, I suppose. Because what was your initial seed for the Sea Women?
It started as a poem in 2014. And then, like you, I started writing a short story. And then I was like, this is too big for a short story.
Yeah.
And there's too much world to fit into a short story. And then I didn't really want to write a novel because I just thought it was too much work.
It's an effort.
I had a conversation with a writing tutor at university when I was doing my MA, and they were like, give it a go, like, you know, give it a try. And that's kind
of... here we are.
Yeah, however many years later.
Yeah, but I think especially the start, it is daunting. You know, this is you're taking on a huge commitment. This is a relationship you're kind of taking on, and you hope it works, especially with your first novel. You don't really know. You're just kind of taking a leap of faith. And I think what it's taught me is just that, you know, perseverance. You've got it within you to persevere. And even if the book hadn't got published, the fact that it got finished, you know, that you wrote this piece of work that's massive, I think is an achievement in itself. And it's almost like an emotional kind of hurdle. If you can get over that, you're like, right, well, what else can I do then?
And I think having I don't know whether you feel the same, but having written one, it makes you think, well, okay, I did it once, and although it was difficult, I had to do it, so it does mean it's possible to do it again.
You can do it again.
So I wonder whether you could tell us a little bit about how you came to get your agent and your book deal.
So my agent's Catherine Summerhays at Curtis Brown, which is a brilliant agent. I came about getting my agent because I had won a Scottish Book Trust New Writers Award and for short stories. And I think I had sent her some work. Maybe had even sent her an extract of the first novel that I tried to write. And she was very encouraging about my writing, but didn't feel that she was passionate about the story. And I think that's really common. I think that's a big hurdle that people have to overcome. Agents can love your writing, but can they sell the story? And if they can't, then, you know, it's not going to work. And then I basically started writing Pharmacist, and I was on a writing retreat with another writer who had the same agent as me, and she read the first chapter and had said, oh, actually, when you're finished, let me speak to our now agents, because I think this would be really up her street. And I think it saved me going into the slush pile and waiting however long to find out if she liked it or not. And then actually getting that connection was super helpful, and my agent read it really quickly, and then things just happened like that. Yes, I signed with my agent very quickly, but from signing to getting the book deal took a couple of years, because my main issue was I didn't know how to finish the novel. And I think there's that real risk, because you've set it in a contained world, you could easily write yourself into a corner. And so for a long time, we kind of fleshed out, like, what was it I wanted to achieve by the end? What was the real arc of the story for me? It took me, I think I had the voice really early on, but to get to the manuscript that we actually sold, it probably took another 2 years of my agent being really patient. But I think also my life, I was having another child. I was trying to get screenwriting off the go. So I think you have to kind of, you know, not give yourself too hard a time. Things happen at the right time. I think I like to think that anyway. I don't know if that's true. So that's how it came to be. And then actually, I don't know how you feel, but when I got the publishing deal, I was like, job done. And then your first round of edits come back, and you're like, oh, I thought I was done. And then I was like, it's stunning. We love it so much. And then you get the notes, and you're like, do you like it? So that again is just another hurdle. Yeah, that was something I hadn't anticipated. I actually quite liked doing the edits, but yeah, every step is a learning curve. I don't know if you feel the same or not. Yeah,
so I wondered whether you could maybe give us a couple of comparison novels to The Pharmacist for readers who are interested in picking up, so novels that you think you could compare it to. I know people hate this question because it's me asking them to be really arrogant, but I'd love us to talk about a couple of novels that you think are similar.
I mean, I would not say that my book is anywhere near as good, but I think, you know, I took a lot of inspiration from books like The Power, Naomi Alderman, and Handmaid's Tale, of course, Station 11. And my favourite little nugget of information is that actually the designer who did the cover of my book did the cover for The Power and some of Margaret Atwood's covers, and he also did the Station 11 cover actually for the UK. So I feel really like I can't compare them to that because they're all amazing. But I think it's that kind of market that my publishers are trying to reach. So if you like books like that and you like dystopian tales or speculative ideas, then yeah, maybe you would pick it up and let me know what you think.
I'd be recommending it to everyone that I know.
Thank you very much. And then, I mean, I don't know if I'll write speculative forever, but my second novel is coming out next year, and that's also speculative. So
yeah, so that was my final question. Could you tell us a little bit about the second novel?
Yeah, so the second novel is called Thirsty Animals, and it's set on a livestock farm near the Scotland-England border. And it's about climate. So it's really about water shortages and how we as a society behave when water has become a scarce and sacred commodity. So there's definite kind of parallels and themes to The Pharmacist, but this one was quite interesting because I got the free world to kind of roam. No one was stuck in a bunker this time. Told from a younger perspective, someone that's 21, so it's kind of that generation that's taking on a lot of the problems that we're leaving behind in the climate. And yeah, so I'll be interested to see what people make of it. I like it now, but I hated writing the second novel. Like, it was that difficult second album. And I've actually I'm about to submit my copy edits back. So I think we're kind of on the finish line. It's done and I can only tweak it from here on in. And I think, again, what we're saying about if you've done it once, you can do it again. There was something really like just relaxing about being like, I got there, you know, because I can't express to you how difficult I found writing the second novel. I don't know if that's just the timing, because you have finished, I'd finished the first one, I was waiting on it coming out, and then I'm now working on the second one, and you just kind of lose confidence as well. I think I was worried about what people were going to say about the first one. So you kind of put yourself through the mill, just thinking like, can I do it again? Will people like it? If they don't like the first one, you know, will they like the second? And I think you just kind of got to put those kind of scary thoughts in the back of your head, because you can do it. You know, if you've done it once, you can do it again.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Rochelle. I really enjoyed chatting to you about The Pharmacist, and very looking forward to reading Thirsty Animals as well. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Chloe. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
That was Rochelle Atala talking about her speculative novel, The Pharmacist, which is out now and available to buy. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.